Hello, and welcome to the Comic Book Page Back Issue Spotlight. My name is John Mayo, and I'll be your host.
And I'm Bob Retall. In this episode, we'll be discussing a wide variety of back issues that John and I have recently acquired or read, as well as a spotlight on a classic comic storyline. We've actually got guesting with us on this episode, Cameron from DCBS. Say hi, Cameron.
Hi.
And Cameron's been kind enough to offer an extra discount at in-stock trades on this particular trade, the Saga of the Super Sons. So that will be up. We will probably have this episode up around mid-January, so till sometime in February. Mid-February, is that fair to say, Cameron?
Yeah, that's
while you
fine.
Have it in stock, we'll have an extra discount on this particular book at in-stock trades. So I have a request from someone on the forum. They were wondering if there was, and I didn't know the answer to the question, but they, you know, you have that CGS8 discount for first-time customers to DCBS, and they were wondering if there was any kind of extra discount to first-time in-stock trades customers.
There's not anything like that, but that's just because there's no programming on the in-stock trade site to actually take care of that type of thing. So that's a really good idea, and it's probably something that we'll do in 2008. But it'll be towards the end of 2008 because we have a number of projects we want to get done for IST earlier on.
Okay, cool.
Cool.
I'll let them know.
Okay.
And then on a selfish note, I sent you an email yesterday.
I did see email in there this morning.
It's just one of my plethora of, you know, add this stuff to things. But one of the things I wanted to add is the X-Men books that are part of the Messiah Complex series.
Okay.
If you've got the extra ones laying around. So if someone could look at it, because I know, like, one's probably coming out this week also.
Okay. Yeah, we do have some extras of those. And we can, whatever we have, we'll email back and we'll make sure that they get out into your next shipment.
And then I've got to send you an email today to put in my order for December. I haven't done that yet.
Okay. Yeah, we've had a lot of Excel orders popping in today, so.
I'm really bad about that, and I hope that doesn't inconvenience you, but I tend to wait to the last minute.
No, it's fine. I mean, we usually have extra people processing the orders on Monday and Tuesday when the deadline is that particular Monday. And Excel orders are super easy, so it's not a problem at all. And one thing that we're doing, there will be an upload Excel order form link on the site, and you can just click that, hit browse, find the order on your desktop or on your system somewhere, and then just upload it. And it'll go right into a shopping cart and you can check out just like normal.
Wow.
Oh, that's cool.
That's really neat.
I've seen it work in tests, or at least on the programmer's computer, but the test server needs Excel installed before it can work, so we have to do that and then make sure it still works.
Right.
But it should be pretty cool.
Good stuff.
So when I'm always harassing you guys with emails about, you know, add this book or that book or something like that, would it go into my order just the same if I, like, picked it on the site and added it to a shopping cart and just threw it into an order? Would it go into the same order? I mean, the reason I always send the emails is because I figured that would, like, create bunches of separate orders. You know, if there was a way for me to, like, add something to an existing order off the site, then I wouldn't pest you with all these emails.
Oh, sure, yeah. The way you're doing it is exactly right. You should send the email because you're right. If you don't, then it would create multiple orders and then multiple shipping charges, which we would back off. But if we forgot to back it off or we didn't notice it, then it could get charged and then we'd have to do credit and things.
That's what I figured. It would be easier to do this way. But that's the thing. I send my Excel sheet in early, but then on the other hand, you know, I'm like pestering you all the time with these emails. It's like things occur to me all month long.
It's no problem. We get lots of those emails to add things to orders. The thing we are going to work on also in 2008, but this might be maybe mid-2008, is something where you could add items to your orders before the order due date. You could add or subtract items up until that time.
Got it.
Yeah, that'd be good, because anything that you put in for us to do, it just makes less that you guys have to do, and I certainly don't mind. You know, it's just as easy for me to upload an Excel sheet as, you know, emailing it.
Well, and that's what we thought.
And that makes less processing, you know. I don't mind doing that.
Exactly, and we thought people would like that better, because sometimes you send in the order, and it could be a couple days, depending how much email we have at that particular time. It could be a couple days before we get it processed, and I'm sure I would worry about it, and I'm sure some customers worry about it and think, oh my gosh, did my order actually go through? And then they're having to track looking for the return email from us, and we figured it would probably just make everything easier all around.
Yeah, there's always emails out there on that DCBS thread. It's like, I sent my email in like 2 days ago, and I haven't heard back, and I don't know what's going on.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, well, you know, hundreds of people all sent their emails in, you know, in this three-day period.
Yeah, that's exactly what happens. And all throughout the month, you know, we get hundreds of emails popping in all the time, but especially at the end of the month. But we did bring in another shift of people doing email about 3 weeks ago, and then last week we brought in another person to do email. So it should gradually get better. Plus these enhancements that we're talking about with the Excel order form and being able to add product to an existing order, that should help email response times too.
Well, that'll be really cool. I'll like that.
Yeah. Sounds like good enhancements.
We're always trying to do them, but they're very expensive. I mean, we actually do lots of enhancements all the time, but some of them are behind the scenes that help us in processing orders and things and processing shipments. You may not see them, but we're working on them all the time to make things more efficient.
I totally believe it.
Yeah.
I mean, out of the 200 plus shipments I've had, the number of errors you guys have had is next to zero, which I find astonishing.
Yeah. I've had like one mispick in 2 years or something, you know. It's like out of the thousands of comic books that I get, it's pretty incredible.
We're definitely very happy to hear that. We know that we make mistakes because we get the emails in shortly after month end, but we're very glad to hear that, and we're certainly working on a couple things, which I think will pretty much eliminate some of those errors, but that's going to take about 4 months, I think, to get programmed, but the program is working on that next, starting probably about second week of January.
When you have people pick the orders, do you have, like, if you got someone like me or John, do you have, like, the same person pick our order each month? Or is it just, like, kind of luck of the draw as to who picks our order?
It's kind of luck of the draw. What happens on Tuesdays, because we get our shipment in on Tuesday, but we can't actually sell anything until Wednesday. You may get a shipping notification on Tuesday, but your package can't actually leave until Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
But on Tuesdays, we just generate all the pick lists and print them out, and people take whatever pick list is on top, and then they just go around the tables and pick all the books. And it's just what you said, it's luck of the draw. Now, for shipping, it kind of depends. For weeklies and twice a month customers, it's kind of luck of the draw for the person who actually takes your order and double checks it, gets it into bags and boards if you bag and board it, and get it into the box and get it shipped out. But for monthly customers, it tends to be the same person because we have people assigned to certain areas.
Interesting.
So another question I had was, I noticed a couple of weeks there you were experimenting with that blown foam packing material, and then you went back to peanuts again.
Right. We actually are going to continue with the blown foam. The reason we went back is that what you saw was the trial period.
Ah.
And we're still determining whether it was cost effective and if we liked it and if it was faster. And while we were doing that, then the trial period ended and we had to still do shipments, so we went back to the peanut. But we liked it a lot, so what we're probably going to do is for small to medium shipments, we'll use those foam packets. And for bigger shipments, the foam packets aren't very cost effective. In fact, it uses up a lot of chemical, and we'll probably just continue to use the peanuts for those. And by big shipments, I just mean ones that have statues and action figures, and they're just big boxes.
Okay. That's usually me.
I was going to ask what qualifies as big.
So if it fits into that small diamond box that you guys probably receive once in a while, or our standard box, and we have three standard size boxes. If it fits in any of those, then it'll probably get the gray foam.
Okay.
Did you like the foam?
I like the foam because it's a giant pain to get rid of those peanuts.
Right.
I just get like zillions of peanuts and I have to like pour them out into some garbage bag or something, you know. It's a real hassle to get rid of all these peanuts. And I save some of them, you know, but I've got, you know, how many shipments I get. I mean, I have two huge garbage bags full of them saved in the garage, and beyond that, I just throw them out. I just get lots of them, though.
Right.
Yeah, I've got a garbage can and trash bag that I just fill up with peanuts. Once it's full, it goes out to the trash. Then I've got loose peanuts that have just, you know, fallen under the couch and crap like that.
Yeah, I can completely understand loose peanuts because here, we in the packaging area, there are loose peanuts. I mean, we're constantly sweeping and getting this place cleaned up.
Oh, I bet.
Now, since we are switching the small, medium packages to the gray Once in a while, if we're really busy and we need more than one person doing the packing, it could be that, you know, some packages go out with the peanuts because somebody's working on a peanut dispenser and somebody else is working with the phone machine. But generally, we're going to be going with the phone machine.
Cool. Should make unpacking and cleaning up on my end a bit easier.
Yeah, and it has helped us here a little bit, too.
Cool. I can only imagine how busy you guys are when a new shipment comes in, and particularly at the end of the month where you've got pretty much everybody you have to ship out to. That's got to be a lot of work.
Tuesdays are pretty crazy. The shipment doesn't get here until about 10 o'clock in the morning, which, I mean, that's good, but if we can get it at 6 in the morning, we take it. And we're working just all day with that. There have been times we've been here till 1 or 2 in the morning to get everything completely finished.
Wow.
And part of the problem is that we love our staff. They're really great, and they're hard workers. Some of them go to school, though, so their school schedules can change dramatically from semester to semester. So it may be that some semesters, Tuesdays are completely free, and that helps a ton. And then other semesters, Tuesdays, they come in from maybe 10 to noon, and then they have to leave for 4 or 5 hours, and they come back. So it's always kind of a... It just kind of depends on the staffing.
Yeah.
And then month ends are, they start on Tuesdays, and then they usually end on Fridays or Saturdays. But once in a while, they'll go through till Sunday, which obviously happened this time just because we got a two-day late start because of the shipping times.
Right, right.
But we did get done, so we're done with this month end.
Wow.
Yeah, the only enhancement that I would love to see but could be problematic on your side until DC and Marvel actually get with the program and start providing separate order codes, but when they have multiple covers that are not incentive covers, you know, but 50-50 covers like on one more day, The only thing I don't like about going with you guys is I cannot pick the cover that I want.
Right. Well, we do tell customers on that, and this, it's kind of a pain for you guys, and we don't mind this solution. So, I mean, you feel free to do it. It's just email us the cover that you want, and then we'll do our best to make sure that's the cover that you get. So it's a pain for you because you have to do the extra email, and with all the variant covers these days, that could be lots of email.
Yeah.
But for us, I mean, it's fine. We don't mind at all.
I just don't know if, I guess, A, I sometimes don't know if there's going to be zombie cover on something necessarily, you know, because it wasn't solicited. You know, like some of these things, you know, it's like Spider-Girl comes out with a zombie cover, and it's like, I don't even remember it being solicited as having a zombie cover, or if I did way back when it was ordered 3 months ago, I don't remember the week that it was shipped.
Right.
You know, so it would be nice if there was a choice somehow when I made the order, if they did it, that could be flagged, not as a guarantee, but just as a suggestion.
Right. I think what happened on some of those zombie covers, Marvel went back and said, here are 10 books that we're going to now offer some zombie covers. We didn't put it in Marvel previews, but we're just going to make some zombie covers, and retailers, if you guys want to order whatever, here are the codes. And we ordered them, but it would be something that most customers probably wouldn't have seen anywhere because it just wasn't in Marvel previews. It was in maybe Previews Plus, which is just an email notification newsletter type thing that Diamond gives us saying, hey, here are things that were outside of previews. Do you want to order them?
Yeah.
I think once we get things operating as efficiently as we can here with maybe less email because we're putting these enhancements in place and we just get more efficient, then that's something that we can definitely take a look at. And maybe we can create a place on the website that will let you maybe add these new covers that weren't in previews or maybe be able to select a cover somehow.
I just have never understood why, you know, Marvel or DC or any publisher would offer something and have it skip the whole previews catalog entirely. That just seems counterproductive.
I don't understand that either. I think that for a local comic shop, that maybe makes a little bit more sense because the local comic shop knows what their customer base is going to want, and they order that, and then they put it on the shelf and it sells. But for online comic shops, it's a lot harder in that respect because it wasn't in previews. We download all of our information from Diamond from that previews file that we get, and if it wasn't in there, then it's not on our website.
Yeah.
And customers don't even know that thing existed. So our sales on previous plus items are way lower than what a normal sale would be. Where for comic shops, I think the sales might be more what they expect them to be.
Yeah, that would make sense.
Well, I know when John does his numbers, like anytime Marvel slaps a zombie cover on a book, it ends up selling 5,000 to 7,000 extra copies from all the surrounding issues.
Yeah.
So it's just like I can understand why they do it because it gives them 5,000 to 7,000 extra comics sold for no action other than putting a weird zombie cover on the comic, you know?
Right.
Well, and that's without it having been in previews. I mean, it may have done better if it had been in previews. So still, it's like printing money at times. Shall we start talking about the Saga of the Super Sons?
Sure.
So what we can do, Cameron, if you've got like any of the particular stories in there that you liked a lot, if you want to, you know, kind of pick them out, what I thought we could do is kind of go through them one by one, and, you know, one of us could give kind of a brief overview without revealing the, you know, many of these have like the hidden twist at the end, you know, like, oh, it's really a weird alien ship or, you know, kind of thing. But just kind of like give a brief overview of what the story's about, and then we can, you know, say a little bit about the story. Then at the end, we'd give a general overview of what we thought of the whole Super Son genre.
Sure. I think my two favorites were Town of the Timeless Killers, just because that was my first Super Son story and my second World's Finest book, and I think I was like 8 when I read it. And then my second favorite, kind of like tied with that, is Little Town with a Big Secret. And that's one that I actually bought recently from one of my friends here at the store that had some old copies, and this happened to be in it, and then I read it. And I thought it was really good, and then a couple months later, that DC offered this cool trade.
Cool, okay.
So should we just start with the first one?
Yeah, do you want to like give like a general overview of who the Super Sons are and the deal was in World's Finest with them, and then get into talking about the series?
Yeah, okay. I mean, the saga of the Super Sons was essentially a series of imaginary stories of if Superman and Batman had teenage sons. And of course, all of these were done in the 70s, so it was, you know, colored by that perspective. And a lot of it was how much it would really suck to be the son of either Superman and or Batman, you know, and have to live under their shadow and have your only real distinguishing feature be, you know, sideburns. And I mean, these were kind of wacky stories with a unique charm to them. I mean, personally, I love them, but I couldn't tell you why.
Yeah. So there were actually 11 of them spread out over the course of several years between World's Finest 215 and 242. And then they had a wrap-up episode in 263 that was sort of different, and we'll talk about that when we get to it. And then finally, many, many years later in the Elseworlds 80-page giant that got pulped, they had kind of a final visitation to the Super Son. So right now, you can pick up all the Super Son stories that were in World's Finest in one place, because DC just a couple of weeks ago put out the Superman Batman Saga of the Super Sons trade paperback, which is a really cool package. So if you like what we're talking about in this episode, you can pick that up. That being said, let's get into the different stories here. John, do you want to give us kind of a summary of the first one?
Yeah, the first one kind of sets up the whole Super Sons and how they're kind of, you know, rebelling against their fathers who don't want them to be heroes. So they basically are kind of given a opportunity to go take down a crime boss in this one city. But Superman and Batman, you know, are not really having faith, so they, you know, do it as literally a test for their sons to see if they can really handle this, and go to a huge effort to set up a fake city for them to take down the crime boss in. And, you know, things kind of progress from there. You know, one of the things that's kind of a hallmark of these stories is obviously, you know, Clark Jr. and Bruce Jr. have mothers, but we never see their faces, we never hear their names, we never know who they are. All of this is really about the generation gap between Superman and Batman and Superman Jr., Batman Jr. And really, I thought this story really set the scene pretty well in a number of respects for just how bad it must be for these two kids to have grown up the way they did, with Batman not letting his son be a hero, not even telling him he was Batman until, you know, late in life. Superman forbidding Clark Jr. from being a Superman and forcing him to essentially live like Clark Kent. I don't know, it was wacky, particularly the amount of effort they go through to create this fake town, just in case these two kids can't take out this crime boss who's on his deathbed. I mean, the guy's about to keel over and they don't think their kids can take him.
They really play up Superman and Batman as kind of real jerk dads. I mean, it's like, man, they have no confidence in their sons whatsoever. And it maybe was really being set up. You know, Bob Haney wrote all these stories, and he was probably playing to the audience of the time, which were younger males who were, in Bob's opinion, probably feeling disenfranchised from their dads or something. So he really played to that, and sometimes these can be pretty heavy-handed, and in this particular instance, it was very interesting how little confidence Superman and Batman had in their kids.
It is a theme that occurs throughout every one of the stories, too. I mean, it's every one of them.
Oh, yeah. Well, and the heroes of the story are Superman and Batman Jr., not Superman and Batman. So it's always going to, you know, because of that, be slanted towards them. But it's funny how heroic Superman and Batman themselves can be while being really bad fathers.
Right.
I mean, just the complete lack of faith of here's this guy who's literally about to keel over and, well, you know, I don't know if you guys can take him. I'm going to set up this fake town, go to all this extra effort versus just, you know, watching with, you know, x-ray vision, telescopic vision from ways away as a safety net or something. It was pretty wild.
Superman and Batman are so understanding of everybody else in these stories except for their son. So you're right, they're completely bad fathers, it appears. They're not understanding at all, no faith or anything. And it kind of makes you think that maybe Superman and Batman are a little bit out of character for the time. I mean, for their other 1970s stories. But it seems like it's kind of necessary for the Superman, Batman, Super Son stories to really kind of go forward.
Yeah, I think so. But it just also gets me how, I mean, it's not only a comic book story, but it's an imaginary comic book story. But how many things are kind of contrived plot devices here and there? Like the whole creating this mirror city, time-shifted city or whatever. And how certain things like that, not only in this story, but in a couple of the others, just kind of happen. And it's just, well, you know, accept it.
This is kind of, to me, the enjoyment of reading these books to some extent, because you look at these books and these stories, and for the time, you know, they're dated in the 70s here. And it's like, each story, as you read it, it's kind of like, okay, there's a relatively straightforward story being told here. And what's the zany angle that Bob Haney's going to come up with that really just kind of puts that mark on it that makes it a thing? Like in this first story, I mean, it could be, you know, the basic story is that you have these two sons, Superman Jr. and Batman Jr., who are trying to work their way out from under the shadow of their fathers, and they have this test where they have to go defeat this gangster. But then the extra weird twist that gets added on is Superman goes and creates this bizarre time-shifted parallel version of the city that's a day off from the real city in some kind of parallel timeline or something, so that they can kind of put these guys in a experimental zone doing this thing, and it's not like they're in the real city fighting the real gangster. And that's the twist for this issue. And there's a similar one in pretty much every one of these stories.
Yeah, and that's part of the fun of it, because it does take something that could be, I don't want to say a bit more pedestrian, but a bit more straightforward, and really kind of, with that extra spin, I think raises the fun of it.
I found it fun to actually look back at the cover in the back of the trade paperback, you know, or if you're reading the actual issues, you know, you look at the issue, and a lot of times that it's capturing, what I like also about these is it really captures the story somehow, you know, what's going on in the story, a lot more so than maybe a lot of covers today, where there's not a lot to do with what's happening inside the story, but they're more just like pinups.
I have to say that when I started buying books when I was 7 or 8, and the covers are really what drew me to the book. And I mean, my first book was that, or my first Super Son story was number 242 in World's Finest, and that cover is just great. I mean, that the woman with the bullwhip or whatever that thing is around Superman Jr. and Batman Jr. is already out, and Superman on the cover is kind of gloating that, hey, your boy's down, my boy's going to save him. I mean, that type of thing, it just made you want to pick up the books. I mean, pinup covers are great because the artwork is just beautiful in many cases, but I just think that these covers are just what you said, Bob. I mean, they really draw you in and make you want to pick up the book.
Yeah, I agree with that entirely. That's why I got a lot of these originally myself, too. It's, you look at the cover and it's like, it tells you the concept of the story and it's like, hey, this is just cool. I want to pick this up. So they do a much better job selling the stories than a lot of modern covers do.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite things also, it still is, about buying back issues, is just the covers of those old books from the 60s and 70s are just so unique, you know, in that the cover itself almost tells a story. You know, you have the word balloons, which it's telling some fragment of the story. It's maybe not an exact reproduction of a scene from inside the book, but it's really capturing some aspect of the comic. So it's great fun to look at these covers. So we'll move on to the next one. Cameron, you wanted to talk about this one.
Sure. This one, I read it about, I don't know, 2, 3, maybe 4 months ago. It was a book that someone had, one of my friends here at DCBS had brought into the store. He had gotten several long boxes from his uncle. And I bought this one from him and read it that night. And it's a story about the two super sons traveling across America, which is kind of a theme that goes throughout all of the stories as they kind of try to distance themselves from their dads. And they're on their way to, well, actually, they're out on the open road, and they kind of encounter this, what looks like a ghost town to start, and it ends up being populated by a few people. And they can tell right away that something weird's going on because they see this little boy in the street, and his mom yanks him back in to the house and says, hey, don't talk to strangers or I'll send you to the Iceman. And Clark and Bruce are kind of wondering, Iceman? And they're kind of wondering what that even means. And they go to a local diner and encounter some people that kind of rough them up and seem to want to get them out of town. And then there's a picture on the wall of somebody that disappears after a while. So there's just some weird things going on in this town, and they're not quite sure what it is. But then they start investigating, and, I mean, without giving anything away, I mean, they discover what the weird thing is. And it's related directly to the Iceman.
Yeah. This one had kind of the feel of a Scooby-Doo story. You know, if it weren't for those meddling kids.
Exactly.
You know, they go into the strange town, find wacky stuff happening, and have to go, you know, solve the mystery. And this was another one that had just a brilliant cover. And the story, you know, the cover doesn't come straight out of the story, but it captures the theme and the nature of the story perfectly.
I like looking at the clothes they have that people wear. They got the tufts, you know, they're wearing these headbands, you know, it's like the motorcycle gang type of guys. They got the, you know, red patterned headband that he's wearing, and just the... You know, people pulling knives on each other in diners and having rumbles. That's Clark Jr. wearing the headband, or no, that's
Bruce Jr.
Bruce Jr. wearing the headband. It's like, what's up with that? When did you think that was a good idea to wear a headband like that?
It goes with the sideburns.
Yeah, really long sideburns.
You mentioned the Scooby-Doo aspect of the story, and one of the other things that kind of resembles Scooby-Doo is that in the early Scooby-Doo, and maybe even later ones, I don't know, the only characters that ever appear in the stories are just the main Scooby-Doo characters and then the one or two other people in the story. And there's never anybody else ever in the story except for maybe occasionally like a chipmunk that antagonizes Scooby-Doo. And that's kind of the same with this story. I mean, they don't really have a lot of innocent bystanders anywhere. It's just the main characters and only that's it.
Yeah, you're either one of the super sons, one of the bad guys, or one of the victims of the bad guys. You know, kind of a thing.
Or alternatively, you're a hapless local girl that the super sons are macking on. I mean, they do a lot of that in these stories. Hey, chick! You're pretty groovy. Can I have a kiss? You know, kind of thing. It's like, it's very strange.
And then the only other group is the disenfranchising, misguided parents, because we see them from time to time.
Yeah.
Well, this one actually, I think, was one of the few that didn't have Superman and Batman in it, because I think this was strictly just the Super Sons, which most of the others was more about the relationship between the sons and the fathers.
Right, the only place that they appear is on the first page, it looks like, where they're kind of like just ghosts kind of hovering over their sons as they start their journey, and they're just kind of talking about them. But yeah, you're right, they're not really anywhere else in here.
Yeah, so this was a fun story. I like this one. Shall we move on to the next story?
Sure.
Which is Cry Not for My Forsaken Son.
Okay, this is a good one. This one, you have this kid in, I forget whether it's Metropolis or Gotham City, that it's a big morality play. You have the fair-haired son who's disenfranchised with his father, who is a doorman at some building, and then he finds out that his real dad is this rich industrialist, Mark King. And he forsakes his square dad who's, you know, lived with him his whole life, and his foster father, I guess, and decides to go with his real dad, Mark King. And then it turns out through a variety of things that, you know, Mark King and his dad knew each other and were business partners earlier in life. And they end up on a Pacific island with an emerald mine, and there's a worker uprising, and there's all kinds of craziness ensues as he works his way through the story. And this one, some of the coincidences that occur in this one were pretty coincidental, let's say.
Yeah.
Getting miners from Gotham City to go mine emeralds on a remote island out in the middle of the ocean somewhere is pretty interesting.
I've been reading a lot of Bob Haney stories just kind of by coincidence, I think. But I've been picking up the Showcase Teen Titans books and the Showcase Brave and the Bold book, and he does seem to do that a lot, where have just plot devices in there just to kind of move things along. And usually the story itself moves pretty normally on the first, 10, 15 pages. And then towards the end, there's usually some sort of plot device or something that kind of speeds things up and brings it to a resolution. So I don't know if that's just him or if that's just kind of characteristic of the time.
I think it's a little of both. Because, I mean, all of these are done in one stories, and you've only got so many pages to work with, so you're going to get to a point where it's like, I need to end the story now. Let's have some stuff happen to let that happen.
Mm-hmm.
There were a couple of things about this story, beyond just the whole morality play, which was pretty heavy-handed, but fun, that really got me. One was just the way this opened, with the wives of Superman and Batman yelling at them, Superman and Batman, about just how horrible their sons are. And Superman's wife refers to him as Mr. Kent, and, Batman's wife refers to him as Mr. Wayne, and stuff like that, and it's like, wow, how formal they are. And again, we see them, from the side, so we don't know who they are, the wives and stuff, and that's fine, that's cool. But this was also one of the few stories where we saw any other established character, and in this case it was Commissioner Gordon for part of a page, and just kind of to set some stuff up, which was cool.
Alfred would be running around every now and again in the stories too.
That's true. Alfred is the other one that's a regular appearance. But this whole thing of, your father may not be as bad as he seems kind of a thing, again, plays into the whole generation gap and father-son relationships that these stories usually center around. But yeah, some of the coincidences were kind of funny. And the other thing that was interesting to me about this story is the way they drew Superman Jr. without the S curl in the hair. And I mean, it's a minor little thing, but usually it's the hairstyle is what differentiates the juniors from their fathers. But usually Superman Jr. has, the S curl and the sideburns, whereas this time he just had the sideburns. It had to be hard for Dick Dillon to convey that these were not only younger versions of Batman and Superman, but different characters. And by and large, he did a really good job. And, that was, in some cases, a degree of subtlety that was nice. In other cases, it's pretty obvious just from the way they're acting.
There's a story coming up, too, where, not only are all four of the Superman, Batman, and the sons there, but then Dick Grayson shows up, and you've got, five people with black hair.
Yeah.
Three of them young, but, you could tell he was having a little trouble keeping everybody looking different.
Interesting, actually, I'm kind of flipping through these stories now that you mentioned that. It seems like from here on out, at least for the next two or three stories, Superman Jr. does not have the S-curl.
Yeah.
He did in the first couple of stories, and maybe this is where Dick Dillon just decided, okay, that's the one way that I'm going to differentiate them is just to give Superman Jr. a regular kind of hairline there.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't have it anymore. He has, by ways back, he kind of has his hair kind of like swooping down over the one half of his forehead, but he certainly doesn't have that anymore. And he did in the first couple of stories. So.
Yeah, the angel with a dirty name, it looks like that's where it kind of starts to maybe reappear a little bit. Like you said, it's just more blue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Although, the story before it, on the side, it tends to swoop a little bit. I don't know. I have to say, Dick Dillon's artwork is just great. I've always loved his work. And when I was first getting into comics, Justice League was one of the books I picked up, and he was the artist generally in there. And I just fell in love with his stuff. It was great. And he does a really good job in all these stories. He does almost all the stories from the early issues. I think there's a Kurt Swan one in here, too.
Yeah, one of them's by Kurt Swan.
Oh, yeah, The Girl Whom Time Forgot.
But all the others, except for the last few, which was by Town of the Timeless Killers, was Ernie Chan. Rich Buckler did The Final Secrets, and then Kieran Dwyer did the one from the Elseworlds 80-page giant. But all of the rest was Dick Dillon. And I think he's a kind of a massively underappreciated artist, because I'm a big fan of those Justice League ones as well. And he's just a solid storyteller. He's got good, clean art.
Yeah.
It doesn't have kind of the big flash, gee whiz kind of, style that you can't help but notice. It just serves the story very well.
Yeah. This next one's one of my favorite ones, Evil in Paradise, just because it's almost the craziest one. So some scientist discovers this hidden civilization down in Antarctica, kind of like a mini version of the Savage Land in Marvel Comics, where you have the unspoiled tribe of, early humans there. And there's, they have these planes that are like flying over, apparently taking all these pictures, and they determine that, these guys have been untouched by higher civilization for a really, whole thousands of years. And one scientist has the theory that it's modern Western civilization that corrupts people and, you know, has all the crime and evil and all this kind of business. And this other guy is like, well, no, man is intrinsically bad, and it's like stress that causes it. So they decide that they're going to have this experiment where they go down and observe. And of course, Batman Jr. is on the side of the guy who thinks that man is intrinsically evil because of, you know, Batman is his father, and that's sort of the thing. Whereas Superman's son is on the side of the scientist of, you know, man is intrinsically good. But boy, this one scientist who thinks that man's intrinsically evil, he's really messing with these natives. He's doing all kinds of crazy stuff to try to taunt the natives into behaving poorly. And it's just...
Well, is it just me, or does he look a lot like Lex Luthor? And granted, that's just because he's bald and he's white, but...
Good. Big bushy eyebrows, but yeah, it's kind of like a Luthor with... Yeah, it's just... It's funny, because he's just going along just messing with these natives continually, and it's like, it's not something that you'd see in any other kind of story. You couldn't publish this story today. I mean, this guy is just going nuts, and Batman Jr. kind of goes along with a lot of stuff that's relatively questionable in this story. So,
oh yeah, I mean, some of the stuff. I mean, this scientist's whole line of thought is, they're going to do bad things if we make them really, really miserable. So let's torture them and see if they flip out. It's like, well, gee, what do you expect?
They're not under enough stress living in their idyllic life here, you know, so let's cut up their food supply, let's kidnap somebody, let's, you know, set insects upon them, all this kind of stuff. It's like, man, you know, this is really kind of cruel, treating these people.
And then he gets upset towards the end when the conditioning isn't working to some extent, and he actually hits the guy. He says, you can't shrug off my conditioning, and he smacks him.
Yeah, yeah.
How dare you not turn evil when you're put under these conditions? And he attacks him.
Yeah. Well, and again, this is a whole heavy-handed morality play. It was fun to read, but again, it's just one of those wacky, it's like, I can't believe they're doing these things.
That's why I like reading these older books, because, I mean, you read them in the time that they're in, and, you know, when I was a kid reading these kind of things, you didn't think anything of it. Now, like, you couldn't publish stories like this. It's just like, it's the only place you're going to find stories like this are, you know, going back and getting these older comics, and it's, you know, kind of like reflection of simpler times and stuff, but it is really interesting the way that they handle these things and the way they tell the story. And again, since they felt that they were telling stories primarily to an 8 to 12 or 13-year-old audience, you know, they've got some kind of point that they want to make in these stories, and they really bludgeon you over the head with it. I mean, there's not a lot of subtlety in how they're trying to get their story point across, because I think the comics creators were of the opinion that, you know, these, you know, 10-year-olds are not that bright, and if we don't really, you know, paint this in broad strokes, they're going to miss the point that we're trying to come across. So they really come pretty heavy across with these things.
Yeah.
It's non-ambiguous about what point they're trying to make.
Or what the moral quandary is. I mean, here the whole thing is man good or evil? And they, you know, set up the case pretty clear-cut. Of course, the funny thing is they leave the answer kind of a, gee, I don't know, to where if they find another idyllic civilization, they can torture those guys, too. And again, this is another one where, you know, a couple of things happen time after time just as, you know, coincidental or plot device or whatever, just to keep the story moving along. But a lot happens in the story as a result of that. And these are, you know, again, morality plays and kind of character-based things and not kind of plot-driven stories in some respects. So those kinds of things with the plot devices and whatnot and coincidences and stuff aren't bad. They're kind of, I think, needed and work well. And then next up, we've got the shocking switch of the Super Sons. And this one starts with Clark Jr. and Bruce Jr., you know, kind of tagging around their fathers, trying to help out, but for some reason doing it out of costume. And, you know, the fathers and sons realizing that they just have a huge generation gap, and they need to have an encounter session at an encounter camp to really get in touch with the fathers and sons with each other. And the twist in this story is the guy at the camp recommends they switch sons. So Superman Jr. hangs out with Batman, Batman Jr. hangs out with Superman, and of course there's some, you know, government experiment gone wrong that, you know, needs to get taken care of and whatnot. This was a interesting story just to see the kind of switch up the pairings and explore those relationships, and I think it worked well in that respect. You know, it's kind of, the other guy's father isn't that bad because he's the other guy's father. But this is one where the sons really were goofing off, off, didn't, you know, take the superheroing seriously or whatever, which I felt was kind of out of character in some respects for them. But, of course, you know, they're going to ultimately save the day, so they're not all bad. This was a good story. I don't think it was one of the best of the bunch, though.
I think this is one story where the dads are hard on their sons, but in this case, they probably deserve it. I mean, there's one point where Batman tells Superman Jr. that you're both immature follow-up, and I think they deserve that based on what they did during the story to kind of follow up the mission. So in some of the other places, they just don't have any confidence in their sons, and they probably should show some more confidence and more support. But here, I think that the dads are right.
Well, yeah, I mean, Superman Jr. had gone off to a rodeo. Of course Batman was right in this case, but you're right, that's a huge difference from a lot of the other stories.
Well, they're not as bad as the one where the kids turn on their dads and, like, put them in that prison camp. Well, we'll get to that one in here. You know, good time. But this one I thought was really funny because they go to this hippie camp up in the mountains, you know, with Camp Enoi Rev, which is everyone spelled backwards. And you got the, you know, long-haired guy with the beard and the big amulet around his neck and just the little images that Dick Dillon draws of, like, the stuff going on at the camp. You know, you got the people holding the woman up and, you know, the trust circle and people slapping each other in the face. Like, what the hell? You know, it's like just weird, weird stuff. It's just like the, you know, he must have read some article, Bob Haney or one of these guys, about some weird encounter group or encounter camp or something, and that gave the idea for this story. But then, you know, the whole thing is then you got this strange government thing with the android and the nerve gas and all this kind of stuff that goes in as the strange element to this story. That was just off the wall.
Yeah, I mean, some of it was just so over the top. Particularly with the camp. But, you know, it served the story pretty well. And, you know, it let them explore the aspects of the relationship they wanted to in this. But, again, that's not something you could do in a modern comic.
The next story, Crown for a New Batman. This one has Robin guest starring. And Batman looks like Bruce Wayne's been killed. So the point of conflict here is Batman Jr. and Robin are having a disagreement over who should take over as Batman. But it turns out that, you know, in elements that make this the most racist story in the book, they've got this really caricatured tribe of Eskimos. Bruce Wayne is apparently making lots of money off of a seal hunting business, killing seals, and got a giant iceberg that's shaped like a polar bear, and one of the most unlikely ice formations I've ever seen. This was a very strange story.
Well, and also unique in the fact that it's centered around the relationship between Robin and Batman Jr., and not only was Batman, you know, since he's ostensibly dead, not in most of it, but Superman and Superman Jr. were not in a lot of it. You know, it was interesting because prior to this, there was no real mention, there was no mention at all of Robin even existing. Yet, it makes perfect sense and whatnot, and this was really interesting to see how Batman Jr. and Robin would interact and, you know, answer who would be the next Batman question.
The thing that's interesting, though, is, okay, so you, given that Batman and Superman have these two sons who are, what, like 16 or 17 in these stories, kind of get the idea, maybe even 18 since they're driving around this motorcycle and kind of being left to their own device. Let's say 17 or 18. They've got to be, you know, they can't be like 15 or something,
right,
Riding around the country on this motorcycle. So clearly, Batman was not married and had this kid when he first took Robin as a sidekick. So Robin has to be, at a minimum, the age of Batman Jr. older than he was when he started out as Robin. So Robin can't be less than 30 in this, you know, but they don't play him like that. You know, they play Robin like he's, you know, in his early 20s.
I was actually thinking Robin was pretty much the same age as Batman Jr.
Yeah.
That's what I was thinking, too.
Both are college age.
Well, Dick even comes home from college at one point for the funeral.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's why I was thinking, like, early 20s, you know, 20, 21, something like that, 22 versus, you know, an 18 for Batman Jr. And it's like, how exactly does that work? But I guess they didn't worry about that kind of stuff in these stories. They're kind of imaginary stories, so let's not let a little tale like that. Not that that never occurred to me when I was a kid anyway, so.
But, I mean, that's part of why Batman Jr. has such a problem with his father is, you know, an earlier story established that Batman hadn't even told his son he was Batman until recently. Yet the whole time he was out going and fighting crime with Dick Grayson as Robin. So of course his son's got to be thinking, you know, what the hell? Why wasn't I invited to the fun?
This story probably has the second craziest plot device in it. I mean, you mentioned, John, in the very first one with creating the alternate city for them to do the adventure in. And then in this one with the, I don't want to give away too much here, but with the death of Bruce Wayne and the, it's out in the newspapers and Dick comes home from college and they have a funeral scene. So obviously they've gotten, you know, a pastor, priest type person to officiate over the funeral, and the wife looks completely broken up, and they dug the grave. They have a meeting with the lawyer about the will. I mean, they've gone to a lot of work here, and then once you read the story, you'll see that was an awful lot of work to go to. I guess I don't want to see too much more without giving things away, but do you know what I'm talking about?
Well, yeah. I mean, the bottom line is the nature of the story is Batman's one of the few unkillable characters, but this is a whole thing it's a whole charade or whatever, but you're right, they go to such lengths to let not only, you know, the people in the room, but the entire world know that Bruce Wayne is dead.
Mm-hmm. And at the beginning, I mean, you've got Bruce Jr., and he's sobbing, he's completely broken up, and he's seeing his dad laying on the veranda or the patio with a knife in his back. I mean, it's just cruel.
Kidding, you know.
That's part of why Batman's such a bad dad. What got me with the funeral scene and the reading of the will is Superman is in costume, yet everybody else is not. And it's like, how come? It just didn't make any sense.
Yeah, well, yeah, you're right. Superman's in costume, and then Clark Jr. is there not in costume. So, I mean, that's almost, and they're standing right next to each other. That's almost a clear giveaway of their secret identity.
Yeah.
Not too many people at the funeral, though.
And the seal hunter or whatever, actually, I think, looks a bit like the guy running the encounter camp from the previous story. Different color hair, but
yeah, he does.
Well, that guy running the encounter camp, his hair would change color from one part of the story to another too. So
did it?
Yeah, it was like really blonde, and then it was more of a darker color.
Yeah, gets more orangey as the story goes on.
This guy looks kind of like Oliver Queen.
I was thinking that too. Well, and this is one of the many stories where it had to suck to be Robin versus Batman Jr., because Batman Jr. has pants, and they're out in the Arctic and the snow and all that cold weather. It doesn't seem to bother Robin, but sure seems like it should.
He's actually kneeling in the snow at one point. I mean, I can barely seem to get snow around my ankles when I'm trudging through deep snow, but here he's practically laying down in it.
Yeah. And really, aside from the being in the background at the funeral and the reading of the will, and a little bit near the end, Superman and Superman Jr. are just cameo appearances almost in this. I mean, I liked it just because it had Robin, and seeing the interplay between him and Superman Jr. was fun. But there were a lot of aspects of the story that were just, you know, outrageous. Again, the whole, you know, Batman's dead. Now, the next story, The Girl Who Time Forgot, was the one drawn by Kurt Swan. And this is another one where it starts with the Super Sons just messing up by trying to help people out, and because they weren't in the information loop on what was really going on, they kind of messed stuff up. You know, Batman Jr. stops a cop from kind of infiltrating, you know, or stopping a crime or whatever, and Superman Jr. stops the train wreck, although it was really a drill for rescue workers and stuff.
And on the Superman one, why is that really a problem? Superman, just go pick the train up and toss it down the ravine. They can still do their drill, you know? What does it matter if it fell down or, you know, came down 5 minutes later?
Well, they want realistic stuff. And it's not like Superman could rebuild the bridge it was on in such bad shape. I don't know. You'd think they could do something.
What I want to know is where that helicopter came from on page 7.
Yeah.
They're on this ship that gets, like, destroyed in the middle of, like, where the Amazon or Central America or someplace. And the ship they're on gets sucked down some whirlpool. Someone actually gets killed, right?
Yeah.
Then all of a sudden they've got this helicopter sitting there. It's like, where did this helicopter come from out in the middle of the jungle? You see the little cross on the hill in the background. They, like, buried the guy.
I hadn't noticed that before, man.
Yeah, I noticed that, and I'm thinking, geez, I mean, Superman Jr. really sucks. Because he's out, you know, rescuing the supplies, not the captain of the ship. I mean, the whole thing is they go with a professor and his son to go, you know, find some Mayan civilization. And, of course, not only do they find it, but they find the two people living there. And this is another one that's just filled with coincidence, you know, after coincidence or whatever. You know, they get sucked down the whirlpool, there's the helicopter that just happens to be there, they pretty much just stumble across the lost city, you know, the lost city, the guy who's there, you know, has, you know, relevance to the whole story. It's, again, it's not a bad story, but the level of again, coincidence and plot manipulation that had to happen was a bit heavy-handed.
It's kind of weird that the archaeologist, at one point, he's talking about how his son, Lance, is gone, that he fell from high up, and he's apparently dead, or at least he's definitely missing. And Clark and Bruce say, hey, don't worry about it, don't give up hope, we'll go search for him. And the guy goes, good idea, and he just walks away and then goes to the city that he's searching for. I mean, if that happened to your son, I mean, you definitely wouldn't just let somebody else go look for him and just kind of go, good idea.
Well, we don't know, you know, how much he actually likes his son, apparently. Yeah, what the heck.
Yeah, and of course, as we know, all ancient Mayan civilizations are nothing but death traps waiting to be sprung on unsuspecting super sons. They get hit by like two or three of them.
They never explain what the deal is with this magic scepter, do they?
I don't think so.
Because usually they come up with some scientific explanation on, well, that wasn't really a magic scepter. You had a giant magnet messing up the helicopter, which caused it to do that when they waved the scepter at it. But they don't seem to have any explanation for it. Is this really a magic scepter this guy was waving around?
Yeah, presumably. And it never even explains when he got it. But, you know, that wasn't critical to the story, so it's just kind of a accept it and move on sort of thing.
Okay, well, we'll move on to Hero is a Dirty Name. This is the this is the one that cracks me up, because the premise of this story is that for some reason, Clark Jr. and Bruce Jr. are really bitter that their dads, like, save people's lives or something. You know, it's like, how dare you run around and save people and, you know, get some kind of acclaim for being good guys, you know, so they decide they're going to put them on trial for this.
There's a scene where the dads are getting a commendation or something like that, and the sons have, like, strike signs, and the Batman one says, Batman is a faker freak, and then Superman's an establishment symbol. I mean, they're just out in public just ripping on their dad.
It blazes. There's our own sons, Bruce Jr. and Clark Jr. You know, it's like, you know, it's like, yeah, what a couple of punks, you know? Like, dads are in this, you know, in this public thing where they're getting recognized by the mayor for, you know, saving a plane full of people, which I thought it was hilarious that the plane, this passenger liner, crashes into the side of a skyscraper and doesn't just, like, explode in a ball of fire on contact, but they say, oh, boy, a good thing that the glass skyscraper kind of absorbed the crash impact, keeping casualties low. Like, whoa?
Well, science was different back then, as was physics.
I guess. It's funny. You know, but, you know, then they go on and they're like, they put their dads in a prison camp, for God's sake. You know, they're like sitting in this prison camp.
Yeah, but we should have expected this, because if you go back to the encounter camp, the guy running it noticed that the Kents show deep, hidden hostility towards each other. And this really shows the hostility Clark Jr. has for his father.
Yeah.
You know, how dare he save lives?
So this one also has some extra guest stars. We have Flash and Green Arrow and Aquaman make appearances, sort of, in this story. But this one was, this was pretty funny, the way they, you know, it's like, I'm sorry, but if I was out getting an award and Steven was standing out in the audience with the protest sign against me, I think I'd be sort of unamused by the general thing. What did I do to set you off, boy, you know?
Yeah. Well, what gets me is, after Batman and Superman Jr. encounter Flash and Green Arrow, the first thing that pops into Batman Jr.'s mind is, that might not be the Flash and Green Arrow. It could be our dads masquerading as them. Like, you know, they're pulling another fast one on us. And given, you know, Batman just faked his own death in a previous story, I can kind of understand that. But of course, they go back, check on the cell, and, you know, Superman and Batman are playing chess. They got nothing better to do, I guess. I mean, there are aspects of this that were just over the top. You know, they jail their fathers for being heroes, and then proceed to be heroes for the rest of the story.
And just the fact that the trial actually occurred, and they were actually convicted and put into that camp.
Yeah. You know, I could see, okay, they're convicted of being heroes, but why they would get jailed for that, I just don't get.
And they don't even get put into a proper jail. They're put into some kind of, like, camp out in the jungle somewhere, apparently, with barbed wire running around it. And, you know, it's like, hey, if I get put even in a camp out in the jungle, one would assume there's going to be at least a little hut in there. Why do they feel compelled to set up their chessboard, like, right next to the fence?
Well, and this bizarre sentence gets, you know, front page on the newspaper, yet no media there to keep an eye on them or anything. It's just bizarre.
Day 3, Batman and Superman sitting in jungle playing chess, you know?
Yes. Film at 11.
Got the Today Show standing there, you know, you've got Al Roker standing out front doing the weather report or something. Would have been Willard Scott back in the 70s.
Yeah, yeah.
Move on to The World Without Men.
Yeah, this was another kind of a sexist one, and another Scooby-Doo one. Drive into a town. This time they actually have a minivan kind of a thing. They apparently ditched the motorcycle. You know, they go into a town, strange stuff happens, and if it weren't for those wacky super sons, you know, they'd have gotten away with it. Now, what got me is, in the van they've got, their costumes just lying around in plain sight. Okay. They just don't have the hang of that secret identity bit yet.
This is the town of all women, and, you know, the super sons are, you know, trying to get their, you know, make time with the girls, and then, pretty is the word, they're all beautiful chicks, but not one man. It's a town of females only.
This is another one of my favorite ones as well. I think this is probably my third favorite one. It's kind of funny. I think all of the Scooby-Doo style ones are my favorite.
What gets me is when the two guys get thrown in jail, they get scooped up with like a bulldozer thing and dropped into a chute into the town jail. That's how serious they are about the whole no-touching thing. You know, and they go from being in the same cell with a bunch of other guys to, you know, suddenly off on their own so they can escape quietly. And with a lot of these stories, again, those are kind of the plot manipulations and that riddle these stories. Yet, you know, don't really get in the way of the fun of them.
I like how Batman Jr.'s riding on Superman Jr.'s hand as he's swimming through the swamp there on page 8.
I noticed that when I was reading it.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, one, why is Superman Jr. swimming? Two, why is Batman Jr. afraid to get wet? You know, it's bizarre.
I did like the one part where, I think this is the story, they have to change costumes because there's apparently Superman Jr. doesn't have a scent, and something's picking up their scent in the story.
They got those dogs. The dogs are coming after him with those bloodhounds.
Yeah. So they switch costumes so that Batman Jr. can be wearing Superman's costume and the dogs won't be picking up the scent. But, I mean, it's not just the costume that would have the scent. I mean, Batman Jr. would be putting the scent on the costume, so it's not like it should really have worked. But.
Well, apparently Kryptonian cloth blocks scent.
And that has to be something that was just completely made up at that point, that Kryptonians don't give off any sort of scent.
I assume that's something Bob Haney pulled out of his backside, like, right at the moment he was writing this story. I'd be surprised if you saw that anywhere else again.
Yeah.
That creature is pretty freaky looking, too. Like, oh, man.
Yeah.
That was on the cover, too. That big freaky monster with the big eye and the big hair coming out around the eye and stuff.
Well, and this is another story where, you know, people die as the Super Sons kind of watch, again, questioning just how heroic they are. And again, another one like you were saying earlier, Cameron, about how the only people in the story are the people that are directly aspects of it.
Right.
There are no innocent bystanders. There are no uninvolved characters.
And like you said, I mean, that makes sense. I mean, you only have so much room to play out a plot, so you're not going to have a lot of extra people, but it's just so Scooby-Doo-like. You can go into a restaurant on Scooby-Doo, and there's nobody there except for those guys, so it's similar to that.
Well, I mean, it's part and parcel of most, you know, mystery shows on TV and stuff. I mean, one of the things that annoys my sister when we'll watch, like, a mystery movie or whatever, you know, I'll be sitting there watching the credits, and the minute anyone whose name I recognize pops up, I'm like, he did it! That's the bad guy! You know? And it's the same thing here. Anyone who speaks more than, you know, a couple of lines of dialogue near the beginning of the story, 50-50, they're the bad guy. Or soon to die, one of the two. But, I mean, that's just the nature of the storytelling conventions. Shall we move on to The Angel with the Dirty Name?
Sure.
You know, this time they actually have a van that's not too dissimilar to the Mystery Machine.
That's right. I didn't notice that. It's green with the pink flowers on it, just like the Mystery Machine, isn't it?
And this has Dora. And this is another one where, my God, the plot contrivances just come one after another after another and are just, you know, shocking. And this is also one that has another established character of Lex Luthor in it. And I don't think Superman and Batman show up at all. But this actually goes into the planet Lexor that we had seen elsewhere in the comics at the time. And, you know, it kind of makes sense that they went for that planet, but it was interesting that Lex Luthor has a daughter instead of a son. Again, some of the plot contrivances, you know, they get attacked on this other planet, and Batman Jr.'s like, Supes, why don't you clobber these gorillas? Superman Jr.'s like, I forgot, this planet's red sun robbed me of my powers just like it did Dad. Like, you forgot that? You didn't notice you suddenly have no powers? I would think you would kind of pick up on that.
Didn't have that tingling feeling like he has no powers? I suddenly feel as though I'm a puppet. Flash moment. I like how the meteor wrecks Lex Luthor's lab. That's one of those plot devices you were talking about. He had the antidote all set up, but oops. This meteor came, and of course, a meteor coming down, it's like, this is the kind of pseudoscience that they had in these things, kind of like that plane crashing into the skyscraper and not like just exploding on impact. This one, you got this pretty fair-sized meteor here. I'd say that's a good, you know, 5-foot diameter meteor. And it's just like kind of sitting there with like wrecked machinery and stuff all around it. But you know, if a meteor of that size actually hit the ground, that would make a crater about a half a mile across or something, you know.
Well, it's like it just skimmed on the surface and
rolled to a stop there or something. It's like, okay.
Yeah, right where it would destroy the antidote.
And it's radioactive. The radiation is what destroyed the antidote.
Yeah. If only it were a non-radioactive meteor, it would have been okay.
Because it rolled up right next to the antidote.
It does look like maybe it broke the vial, so that maybe that's part of it, too. But
yeah, you can see the broken vial there with the stuff spilled out.
I have to say, this is definitely one story that I didn't understand part of it. I didn't understand how they needed to get the venom to actually produce the antidote or something. I've read these stories about 2-3 weeks ago, so I'm getting a little fuzzy on a few of them, but that part just didn't make a lot of sense to me.
Well, at first it was like, we need the venom of this big weird creature to make the antidote, but then all of a sudden Superman Jr. gets the disease and he just lets the thing bite his hand and all of a sudden he's cured.
Right.
So it's like the venom in and of itself is a cure.
Right.
I think what they were going to do is remake the original antidote Lex had created. The daughter finds a way to do it faster if they had that venom. But then once that thing bites Superman Prime, it mixes with his blood and the whole Kryptonian thing. And that created essentially a different antidote.
Okay. So basically three possible antidotes then.
I think it was just like, I only have one page left to finish this story, so we got to move it along. I don't have time for them to be mixing up an antidote. So, you know, let's just move to the conclusion of the story.
Yeah, it's not only one page, but I've got, you know, 6 or 7 panels to do it in. Let's just jump to this. Yeah, there's a definite expedience to the storytelling at times. And this is one where, really, I thought the cover to this storyline was one of the worst, to be honest, because there's nothing about it on the cover that really indicates that the two characters you're seeing are Superman and Batman Jr., whereas all the others, it's very clear that you're dealing with the sons. Well, most of them, not all, so. And next up, we get to the Town of the Timeless Killers.
This is definitely my favorite one, and I'm sure some of it's just nostalgia, because it was my first Superman, Batman, Super Sense story, and it was my second issue of World's Finest ever, and I was probably 8 years old, and I read the thing probably 15 times, but it's definitely my favorite one. And in this case, the Super Sense they're continuing on their journey, and they have a dune buggy now. It'd be neat to be able to have all these different vehicles that they have, but they travel through this needle's eye, or this rock formation, and Bruce wrecks the dune buggy, and they have to walk into this dry gulch type deserted town. And as they go into the town, they keep encountering these famous old Western characters, none of whom like them and all want to kill them. And they just basically have an adventure in that town trying to defeat the three or four Western characters. You know, as I looked through this and read it again, probably for the first time in, oh, it's got to be like 30 years, this artwork is, it's so good. I mean, this artwork could be in comic books today. I mean, I think all the artwork in this whole trade paperback is just excellent. But this artwork is very clean, and I just think that they did a really good job on it.
Yeah. Well, and it also is a story that kind of shows just why Superman might be disappointed in his son. The guy gets cut, he bleeds, he faints. You know, maybe it was a little more than that, but you know what I mean. And the whole, I've never seen my blood before, I'm scared, all that kind of thing. This is one of the ones where, you know, again, Scooby-Doo, they stumble into the wrong town and, you know, wackiness ensues. But it had a bit more intelligent people they were going up against, and one where the two sons, I think, were in some serious jeopardy this time. And doing the whole Old West spin on it was kind of fun, and the way they had to kind of outsmart the gunfighters was good, too. And again, the cover with the girl with the whip and stuff was great.
I think that's the best cover of all of them. And again, it might just be the nostalgia talking, but that is just an awesome cover. And I really liked Ernie Chan's work. He used to do a ton of covers. As a little kid, though, I thought his last name was Chua or something. I didn't understand that signature.
He actually went under, he was at some point Ernie Chua also. So
okay.
That's the same guy. And on some things, I don't know if his real name was Chua and then they made it Chan because they figured it was easier for people to deal with or what. But there were two different versions of his name out there.
I never understood that, but I always loved Owen's cover.
Yeah, he does a good job in the art in this.
I loved when he did Conan. I thought the Conan stuff that he had in, like, Savage Sword.
Now, when the gunfighter goes up against Superman Jr. and shoots him, he basically winds up shattering this mirror. Nowhere is it ever explained where in this Old West town they find this, I don't know, 6-foot by 6-foot square mirror, position it perfectly, etc. You know, that's just one of those plot devices that just kind of happens that you just got to go with.
Yeah, I think behind the bar in the saloon probably is the place you usually find big 6-foot-long mirrors in old Western towns.
That's true. Okay, so there was at least a source for the mirror. I'll grant you that.
But how you get it down and get it to, you know, freestand in the middle of the street, that's another issue.
Yeah.
I did like the scene where Batman Jr. challenged the rifleman to shoot the cards out of his hand, and he did. He shot them all out of his hand, and then he was out of bullets, and then he was able to swing up there and kick
him. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure I would have held the cards quite that way. I would have had them more out at my fingertips.
Yeah, he's got it so that his fingers could have been blown off, didn't he?
Yeah, but I did think that was reasonably clever. Probably one of the smarter things Batman Jr. did in a lot of these stories.
Are you ready for the buzzkill?
Yeah.
I like that in the trade paperback right before this next one. Get ready for the buzzkill.
Because that last story we just talked about is kind of the last of the classic Super Sons. And this next one was not written by Bob Haney. It was written by Denny O'Neil. And as much as the Bob Haney ones had plot devices that came out of nowhere, this final Secret of the Super Sons, I think, topped almost all of the ones that Haney came up with. And basically, this was done in 1980, so it had been a couple of years since the last story. And they were trying to essentially bring the Super Sons into some semblance of continuity without bringing them into continuity. And they decided to kind of retcon those imaginary stories into computer simulations off Superman's supercomputer in the Fortress. I don't know that they really needed to do that, but this was one that I really enjoyed when I read it. Just again, because of how wacky it was. You know, it starts with the Super Sons defeating Dr. Savannah, and then pulling out to Superman and Batman saying, gosh, well, you know, that answers that question. You know, of course our Super Sons could have done it if they existed. Now, why Superman and Batman ever wondered that, I don't know. But, you know, it was interesting.
You know, they don't like football, so when they're, like, just hanging around, they gotta have something to do. They run simulations of what their Super Sons might have been like had they been faced with the challenge of Dr. Savannah.
Well, and this is one of the few times I think they weren't horribly disappointed with the Super Sons. But they leave the thing running, and through the magic of a mysterious plot device known as a page break, they go from Superman and Batman Jr. flying at super speed inside the simulation to Superman dumping radioactive ore into the disintegration pit, and somehow magically Superman and Batman Jr. come to exist in the real world of the DC Universe. And, you know, that's about the extent of the explanation we get. But then we get the fun of those two kind of, you know, existing in a world which doesn't know them. And this is the first storyline that actually has Lois Lane in it. Now, in theory, she could have been the mother of Superman Jr., but that's never revealed in any of the previous stories. And when Superman Jr. comes across Lois Lane and says, "No, I'm his son," she doesn't take it too well. The one thing I really loved about this is when Superman and Batman Jr. encounter Batman. There's a couple of panels with Batman just kind of walking around, looking at Batman Jr., just kind of, you know, trying to piece together what's going on. And the coloring of Batman versus Batman Jr. Batman's got a darker blue, almost purplish cape, whereas, you know, Batman Jr.'s got more of the lighter blue, kind of the more, I almost want to say, golden age, or certainly, you know, hardcore silver age color to his costume. And it's a subtle thing, but really sets the two apart. And of course, meanwhile, Superman's fixing all the wanton destruction that's happening all over the world where the Super Sons have been, because, you know, they're not real and they're apparently destroying the fabric of reality as we know it. It was a bit of a heavy-handed, you know, story of, you know, to save the world, we must destroy our sons who really shouldn't have existed in the first place. But it was fun to at least see these characters exist in a bit more of a real sense than they had, and kind of play a little more into the main DC universe of the time. But it was very much an end cap for those characters. After this, that's it, they're done. It was definitely the furthest in tone and style from all of the stories.
Yeah, I think it was just, hey, let's put the final nail in those imaginary stories we've been running for all that time. Explain them away and make it so that we don't ever see one again, pretty much. Then we get that one final one in the Elseworlds 80-page giant, which never actually saw the light of day anywhere. So this is, I believe, the first time anywhere you're ever seeing this particular story.
I think 1,000 or 2 may have survived in the UK or something. But yeah, the Elseworlds 80-page giant was put together, it was published, they didn't like one of the stories, they pulped the entire run, and while one or two of the stories have shown up elsewhere, yeah, this is the only place you find this story, which kind of sucks. It really annoyed me that they, you know, destroyed that whole comic. And it's funny because this storyline is almost a mirror image of the Batman fakes his death storyline, except in this case it's Superman who fakes his death.
This one was much more similar in tone to the classic Super Son stories. They did a good job of, you know, they have the crazy plot devices and, you know, kind of things going on. So they, in very few pages.
Yeah, because this was only, what, 8 or so pages, give or take? Maybe 10?
I think it's 10.
Who wrote that story? I forget. Oh, Bob Haney. Oh, wait a minute.
Yeah, Bob Haney wrote it.
Yeah, so I think that makes sense that it's more like those older stories.
So he let, you know, they let Bob come back, you know. Sure, he was retired at this point, and put an end cap on the Super Sons. Very fitting.
He has that Teen Titans story coming out, too, that Lost Annual.
Oh, right, right.
So that should be pretty fun to read, too.
I mean, while his stories have, you know, just wild plot manipulations and stuff, they're fun and entertaining stories. You know, they're good character pieces. They, you know, move forward at a good clip. They don't feel the least bit padded or pointless. I mean, all in all, I thought this run of stories was just great. I enjoyed reading them when I was growing up. I've gotten all of the World's Finest issues that they're in, but was happy they did the trade so I'd have it all in one collection, too. And there's talk that the Super Sons exist on one of the worlds in the current Megaverse or whatever in DC.
I think that would be a great idea. I think that's the one thing I didn't like very much about that final Secret of the Super Sun story, is that it felt like this was it for them, and it was kind of a rationalization story. And I just didn't understand why they would do that. I mean, you have this cool property, and it seems like you could continue to use it, even if you modify it here and there. So if they're part of this, the 52 worlds, I think that's just great.
Well, I think in the mapping out of the multiverse that they had in one of the DC Nation columns a while back, they put it as Earth 16 or something, claiming it shows up in Arena, but I don't recall anything in Countdown Arena that had the Super Sons. But I think there's a lot more they could do with this concept.
Yeah.
And the whole disavowing that they did in that one story, I thought was, like you said, kind of unfortunate, and why did they do that?
Now, they did put Earth 16, I just checked, as the Super Sons Earth, the Earth where the Super Sons existed.
Because, I mean, I would have loved to have seen a story where they encounter, you know, Hawkman Jr. or Aquaman Jr. or, you know, other sons of heroes or something. Or hell, a Joker Jr. could be a hilarious story if done right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's so many possibilities here. I hope that they do something with these characters, you know, if they're actually in the multiverse now. And I would hope that that's part of the reason they published this trade, was because they have plans for these characters.
Yep. What's the discount going to be on this trade, Cameron?
45% on Insect Trade.
So that'll make it like $11. And it's like 250 pages of stories for $11. And you can't go wrong with that. I mean, this is hours and hours of entertainment. You know, it's not something that you just breeze through. I mean, I probably spent a good 3 hours reading through.
Yeah. Well, and it's a fun couple of hours, too.
Yeah.
You know, it's a bit wacky, it's a bit Scooby-Doo-ish, but if you go in just wanting to have a good time and wanting to explore the concept of what it would be like if Batman and Superman had sons, this is excellent stuff. You know, it's great Bob Haney writing, and Dick Dillon, fabulous artist. It's definitely one I was happy to reread. So do we have any other kind of final thoughts on the saga of the Super Sons?
I have point out that there were a couple of other Super Sons stories, not exactly these same Super Sons, because I think what distinguished this run was they were pretty much all written by Bob Haney, except for that, you know, one by Denny O'Neill where they're disavowing the Super Sons.
Right.
There were a couple of Superman Jr., Batman Jr. stories told over in Action Comics that had Superman Jr. and Batman Jr. They're slightly different characterizations, and they weren't written by Bob Haney, so they don't count as canon Superman Sons stories. But they were imaginary stories also, and those were pretty fun. And those were actually the first Super Sons stories I ever read, were over in the Action Comics ones.
Well, and then there was also some earlier ones in World's Finest in the mid-60s. But the Sons were more elementary school age versus, you know, college age.
Right.
So they, too, don't really fit this kind of classic era of the Super Sons.
Right. And they were probably written by somebody else also. So I think what really distinguishes this set of Super Sons stories is that they were all Bob Haney stories.
Yeah.
And really the artwork in all of these, I know I've already said it, but it's so good. And that last story before the new Bob Haney one with Rich Buckler, he did so many covers when I was growing up. I always liked it when he did interior work, and he did do that story. So the artwork in all of these stories is really, really good.
Yeah. Well, and again, the other unifying theme is the whole generation gap and, you know, being able to have a Superman and Batman that were not the establishment figures, but were the kind of the hipsters of the time, if you will. It was just kind of fun.
Yep. So Cameron, do you want to tell us a little bit about some of the things we're looking forward to from DCBS and in-stock trades in 2008. I know you were telling John and I about a couple of them. You want to?
Oh, sure, sure. Some things that we're planning for Discount Comic Book Service with the Excel order form, we'll keep that going just like we always have, but we'll make there a way so that you can upload the order form directly into our system. There'll be a link on the site that says Upload Excel Order Form. You click that, you click a browse button, find the form on your computer, and then just upload it. And it'll go into a shopping cart and just check out like normal. So you won't have to wait for us to confirm the order. It'll just get uploaded immediately for you. So that's one thing. That could possibly happen in the next couple weeks. I've seen the programming for it on the programmer's computer, and it looks great, and we just need to test it on the test server before we put it on the regular server. And then the ability for customers to be able to add merchandise to their orders before the order deadline. We'll actually add or delete if there's a particular book you didn't want anymore. You can take that off, too. That'll hopefully be in place in the middle of the year next year. Something that we didn't talk about earlier was First Light. That's a new section on our website where publishers and creators can put up story summaries, character summaries, artwork, and things like that related to properties that they own or that they work on. And that should be going live in the next couple of weeks. It'll be pretty sparsely populated at first because we're just putting things up and contacting different people to say, hey, do you want to put some stuff up on the site? But it could grow to have lots of different things in it. And any publisher and any creator can sign up to put their stuff up. There'll be a little sign-up page where you get a username to log in, and then you can start uploading your stuff. So hopefully in the next couple of weeks, we've tested that, and it looks great. There are a couple of small bugs, but nothing big that would prevent it from going live. see. We also have all of the trades on in-stock trades. Those are now on DCBS, and we're doing a little bit of tweaking, but anything that you can buy in-stock trades, you can now also buy on DCBS if you want to. Just add it to your regular order. It might save you shipping overall.
Well, that's cool. I may have to take advantage of that, damn you. Spend more money.
Yeah, sorry about that.
If you need a couple of guinea pigs to try out that Excel uploading thing, John and I would be happy to upload our January order
okay.
in a couple of weeks and help you try it out.
Yeah,
that'd be great. Yeah, I'll definitely take you up on that. I know for in-stock trades, we've got some things coming up too. We're going to add gift certificates towards the end of next year, and we'll continue to add titles. We've been adding 60 or so titles every week, and we'll continue to do that throughout 2008 as publishers keep producing things, and we'll go and backfill some publishers to the best that we can. We've added a lot of manga, but we've been adding manga kind of from new releases on, and we can go and backfill some of those titles. If people have requests, they can send them in, and we can always see what we can do about adding certain things earlier. And I know we have lots of other things getting ready, so it's hard to think about them. Some of them are actually internal things that just kind of make us more efficient or make things easier for us. So we're always working. You guys might not be able to see what we're doing necessarily on the website, but there's always something that we're doing to try to make things better.
Cool.
A lot of these things that we do, too, come from you guys. If you make a suggestion, we write it down, and it might take a while before we can act on it, but we act on lots of suggestions that you guys give us.
Definitely. I've noticed a couple of changes you've made over time that I found really helpful. I mean, even little things like having the total on the packing list makes life a lot easier for me, because then I can just, you know, check everything off, make sure it's what I thought should have come out, and say, yep, the totals match, I'm good.
And I think that suggestion actually came from you, and that's why we put it on there.
Yeah.
I remember you sent an email in, and I don't think it was something that was already on our list, so it works.
Cool. So I've been a huge fan of your company for, you know, geez, 4 years now since I switched over to it. And I got to say, you do a phenomenal job on quality of service and stuff. I've gotten, geez, I don't even know how many comics through you over the years. And no service is perfect, but you guys are damn near perfect. I would be hard-pressed to name more than a handful of mistakes you've made out of over, you know, 200 and some odd weekly shipments.
Well, thank you. We appreciate that. We definitely like to hear it. It definitely makes our day when we come across an email or comment like that. And you're right that nobody's perfect, but we are definitely striving to get as close as we can. And even 5 mistakes out of 200-some shipments, for us, it's still too much. So we're still trying to tweak things and put new processes in place to even eliminate those. And we've added a little bit of staff on email, because I think probably the worst thing for us is being behind on email. So that's something that we recognize, and we've added a couple shifts there to take care of that. And it won't fix itself perfectly, but we'll continue to add as we can. So
one thing you might do is just set something up so that you just send an acknowledgement really quick to people. You know, a lot of times if they just got something back saying, we got your message, we do have it, and we're working on it, and you'll hear back from us in a couple of days, kind of thing. Because a lot of times when people send the email in and they just hear nothing, it's kind of like, well, did they get it? Did it get lost in transmission or something like that? So at least just some kind of quick positive confirmation to people that you did in fact receive their email. That would probably go a long way towards reducing the anxiety in some of these folks that send in a question or, you know, whatever.
Right. That's a good idea. I'll also look at our email program and see what sort of functionality it has for that. That's a good idea.
Cool. Well, and I've got to say, on the rare occasions when a mistake has happened, you guys have been excellent about getting it fixed, you know, promptly and with no hassle on my side, which I really appreciate.
Oh, yeah, no problem. If we've made a mistake, then by all means, we are definitely going to fix it for you. So, yeah, I appreciate that.
Well, I used to work at a comic store when I was in college and stuff, and I was doing the pulling of books and stuff like that, and yeah, I can only imagine how many customers you've got and how much work it is, but, I mean, it's monotonous. It's not hard work, but it's easy to make mistakes. And I have had times when I was shopping at a local store, I'd go in, I'd ask for my books, they would hand me the stack, and just by looking at the size of the stack, I could tell there were mistakes, because I, of course, buy too much.
I've gone through, probably over the years, 5 or 6 regular comic shops, and DCBS is now my comic shop. But over the years, the regular kind of, I've always had a pull list. You know, I've always ordered my stuff in advance and had it all waiting for me. And like John said, in like a year and a half, I think I've gotten like 1 pick error out of DCBS, and that is way better than any shop that I've ever had my list with, because I would get pick errors, you know, almost monthly from most of the shops. But there it's not that big of a deal. You know, you go into the shop, you have a pick error, and it's like, oh, you didn't put X in my thing, and here it is on the shelf, and you just pick it off the shelf. You know, so it kind of like self-corrects, or it's a little harder, you know, when it's, you know, something that has to get, you know, sent halfway across the country or something. So I certainly appreciate the fact that you have virtually no pick errors.
Well, thank you. And you're right. That is a problem, because with an internet service, there's just no way to fix that error immediately. And with a weekly customer, you can get it into their next weekly shipment, so that minimizes the time somewhat. And with a twice-a-month customer, you know, it's a little bit longer. But with a monthly customer, it's, you know, 30 days before they get their next shipment. So, yeah, we try not to make those types of mistakes, because it can really – I mean, you're reading the storyline. You don't want to miss a particular issue. On the other hand, I mean, it's hard for us to always justify sending out a $1.79 book at – even $2 of bound and printed matter mail, or, you know, $5 or $6 with DHL to correct it. So we want to make sure that we don't make those mistakes to begin with. So, you know, that's all good. We do have something coming up it's going to take 3 or 4 months to program, and I'm sure, you know, it'll probably take even a little bit longer, because something, you know, always goes wrong that you have to kind of fix. But it should virtually eliminate all that problem. So hopefully that's going to work out first quarter next year.
Cool.
Well, I say next year, but by the time people listen to this, it'll already be 2008. So.
Yeah, most definitely. And then you were saying already that the in-stock trade stuff will be available on DCBS. That's a good thing.
Yeah, that's like that right now. There are some things that we're tweaking. And once we get the tweaking done, then we'll make the formal announcement. But it works. So anybody that wants to take advantage of it right now, that it'll work.
I'll have to think about that. There's some stuff that I've been considering getting in trade and stuff. I just haven't gotten off my lazy rear to actually do anything about it, because I tend to read most stuff in monthlies. Cool. I'm trying to think if there's anything else about DCBS and in-stock trades we should be sure to mention. Obviously, the 40% off for most new comics through DCBS, great selling feature. Much appreciated.
Oh, no problem. I mean, the whole idea is that we want people to be able to buy as many comics as they want and support the industry, so we try to price it so that they can do that. And then on new issues, new number ones, and the items that you guys have been sending to us for good jumping on points, putting those at 50 to 75% off, we think that is a good way to get people to try new things.
Yeah.
Well, it certainly worked for me, because there are a number of things that I've tried, just because it's like, it's that cheap, how could I pass it up?
Exactly. You know, it's like, I'll try that stuff, and, you know, a lot of times if I like it, I'll keep on getting it, which is the idea, you know, so I think that works good.
Well, and I think it's a good incentive plan to get people on new titles, keep them on titles when creative teams shuffle and things like that. So it's something I definitely appreciate that you do. And I've never understood other retailers who are so down on discounting, because if I weren't getting my comics through you at the discount I'm getting, I'd be buying significantly less comics than I'm getting now, paying more for it, and, I mean, that helps nobody.
That's kind of how we look at it, too. I mean, everybody has their own business model and their own circumstances that they have to work with, but, I mean, that's just how it is. You have to deal with that stuff. But this works for us, and so that's kind of how we do it.
Cool. Good to hear. So anything else, or are we pretty much done?
I think that's okay for me.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure having you on and talking with you.
Oh, no problem. Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
Yeah. Anytime you've got another storyline you want to talk about, or any other kind of announcement for DCBS or in-stock trades, let us know. We'll have you on, or we'll play the announcement or whatever. And, you know, you're doing a great job running a good company, and it's greatly appreciated.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Cool. So I think that wraps it up. The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.